It's time for Let's Talk with Brian Pettaway.
Good morning, happy Sunday, and welcome to Let's Talk. I am your host, Brian Pettaway. And immediately, what I want to jump into quickly is why we changed the name of the show and the time of the show. I mean, radio is, you know, no different from life. Inevitably, there's going to be change, especially if you're trying to improve your brand and trying to make things better for your listeners. And that's exactly what we're trying to do. So if you tuned in at 9 a.m. to hear me, which is where I used to be, then you caught the last hour of our new Sunday morning show, 6 to 10 show, called Sunday Morning Soul, featuring Gavin Montgomery and Baltimore's original midday diva, Doreesa Harvey. Now, these two have been around for a long time. They're no newbies. They're no slouches for sure. They're very seasoned and experienced radio personalities, and they make a tremendous Sunday morning team. They will, from 6 a.m. to 10 a.m., get your spiritual soul stirred with great gospel music and guests, and then I'll follow that up at 10 o'clock, and you know what you get with me. I'm going to wake up your intellectual side and tell you what's going on in the secular world, right? So it's a great lineup. I'm very proud of it. I'm so happy that we're able to do it. And, you know, from 6 a.m. now until 11 a.m., we got your Sunday mornings locked up. You don't need to go anywhere. You get everything you need right here on 1500 Radio. Now, the reason I changed the name to Let's Talk from On the Weekend Edition is because when I started this show, it was a spinoff from what I was doing during the week. I was actually doing news on the April Watch Show every weekday. So it made sense that when I started my talk show, which was a spinoff from the weekday show that I was doing, that I call it the Weekend Edition. Well, now there is no weekday edition. It just seemed silly to me to keep calling it On the Weekend Edition. So then I sat down and I thought, well, what can I call it? I mean, I couldn't even call it just a news show anymore. I don't just do news. And I just don't talk about a particular topic. So I couldn't call it a political show. I couldn't call it a religious show. I couldn't call it a sports show. So I said, let's keep it simple. We'll call it Let's Talk. And that will allow us to continue to talk to every and anyone about every and anything without limitation. For example, today we're going to be talking about affirmative action. And unless you've been living under a rock for the last 2 weeks, you know exactly why we're going to be talking about affirmative action. And yes, we're going to talk about the history of affirmative action and why it was established and for whom it was established and how many people it's helped since its existence. But from the perspective of a chief judge, a black chief judge, retired, who was beginning to establish his own long and illustrious law career during the civil rights era. I just can't wait. And of course, we've got the Petty. It wouldn't be Less Talk if we didn't have the Petty. So the Petty will be with us also. He'll be talking sports with us today. All kinds of stuff from baseball to boxing. Football is finally out for the year except for the OTAs and the mini camps. And I'm sure he'll have something to say about that as well. But first, you got me, and you know I'm going to do the news first. So as always, I hope you're feeling great, because I'm feeling great. I've got lots to discuss, so let's get right to it. Well, Fox 45 News is reporting that the Baltimore City Police Department is announcing that a 17-year-old boy has been arrested in connection to the Brooklyn mass shooting that left two young people dead and 28 others injured during a block party in the area earlier in that week. On Friday, at around 7 a.m., police said members of the homicide and SWAT team arrested the teen after conducting a search warrant at his residence. Detectives took the teen to the central booking intake facility, where he was charged with possession of a firearm by a minor, assault weapon possession, reckless endangerment, and a handgun in a vehicle. Police said three of the victims from the shooting are still in local hospitals, but all listed in fair condition. Also, 1 year after motorist Timothy Reynolds was shot dead at a downtown intersection, a former Squeegee kid is preparing to stand trial. The 15-year-old will stand trial for murder on July 17th. I can't believe it's been a year already. That incident drew attention from City Hall, which then formed a Squeegee Collaborative, which was what the mayor did, and that enacted new policies and saw the number of Squeegee kids decreased at city intersections. It also made the commissioner at the time post Baltimore City cops at that intersection, sitting in their cars being paid overtime but not being able to interact with the Squeegee kids. And a lot of critics, including myself, felt that the mayor did too little, too late. Suspected that this young man will plead self-defense, and I'm very eager to see what will take place in this court case on July 17th. And speaking of court cases, the FBI says it's working with partner agencies to assess and respond to threats as classified documents prosecution moves forward against Donald Trump. Individual prosecutors involved in the classified documents case against former President Donald Trump are facing substantial harassment and threats online and elsewhere, according to extremism experts and a government official familiar with the matter. Experts say that they frequently observe violent rhetoric targeting people who are blamed for undermining the former president. not just prosecutors involved in the criminal investigation surrounding Trump, but also swing state election workers refuting false claims of voter fraud. Far-right Trump supporters are posting the names of prosecutors and government workers online and yelling this information at demonstrations, threatening them and sometimes revealing details about their personal lives. At the Justice Department, officials have responded by trying to keep the names of prosecutors and agents working the Trump case from becoming public in official documents, congressional hearings, and less formal conversations about the case. But it's a tricky task, given that the prosecutors' names are listed in public court filings and their names and information about witnesses are accessible to Trump as a defendant in the case. The former president has written social media posts directly attacking people involved in investigating him. You know, Trump is eventually going to get someone killed. I will never understand why he doesn't have to abide by a gag order in reference to his court cases. I mean, he's really not going to be satisfied until he gets someone killed with his rhetoric. I mean, it's unbelievable what he's able to get away with. I just don't understand why he doesn't have to play by the same rules as everyone else. Speaking of someone else who's apparently not been playing by the rules, one of Trump's most staunch supporters and straw men, former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani, was the topic of conversation at a Washington, D.C.-based bar discipline committee, where on Friday night they concluded that he should be disbarred for frivolous and destructive efforts to derail the 2020 presidential election in support of former President Donald Trump. A three-member panel declared in a 38-page decision that Rudy Giuliani claimed massive election fraud but had no evidence of it. By prosecuting that destructive case, Mr. Giuliani, a sworn officer of the court, forfeited his right to practice law. Giuliani says he plans to challenge the panel's findings and recommended sanction in front of a larger bar discipline board. His ultimate disbarment or other penalty would be decided by the D.C. Court of Appeals. Ugh, I would love to see this man disbarred. Love to see him disbarred and prevented from ever practicing law again. Also in the news, the parent of Facebook, Meta, on Wednesday officially launched its Twitter competitor, Threads, after first confirming his plans for the app just 3 months ago. Threads is already off to a strong start. The app received 30 million signups as of Thursday morning, according to the company. Threads is already touting a large number of brands, celebrities, journalists, and many other prominent accounts. Now, Threads could pose a serious threat to Twitter, which has faced backlash since Elon Musk took over the platform in October 22 and has run it by a fly-by-the-seat-of-your-pants approach. Twitter has become particularly vulnerable in recent days, angering users over a temporary limit on how much content users can view each day. And for Meta? Well, Threads could further expand its empire by popular apps and provide a new platform on which to sell ads. So as the billionaires Mark Zuckerberg and Elon Musk continue to battle, it appears that the real winners of this tech war between those two is actually us. So fight on, gentlemen. All right, so let's shift gears and get into the topic of today, which is affirmative action. Now, like I mentioned earlier, unless you've been under a rock, you know that the Supreme Court recently overturned and repealed affirmative action, saying that it's unconstitutional and it violates the 14th Amendment. Now, when the Supreme Court repealed Roe v. Wade last year, I was annoyed and I was angry. But when they reversed the decision of affirmative action in recent days, I was shocked and also very scared. And I'm going to tell you the reason why. A lot of people are talking about the education aspect of affirmative action and how it's going to drop drastically the amount of black applicants to private and public institutions. And I agree, it's going to have a huge effect on that. What really burns me, though, is the argument of the Chief Justices when they speak about why they dismantled affirmative action. For example, Chief Justice John Roberts, argues for a more race-neutral admissions practice, which is an odd descriptor for higher education policies in the U.S., given that the structural racism has been the overreaching organizational frame for our country, and higher education is still overwhelmingly white. It makes no sense to me. This country has never been and is still not colorblind. And simply because Chief Roberts and Clarence Thomas say that it is colorblind, it doesn't make it so. It's never been that way. And as far as Clarence Thomas goes, Chief Thomas, here's a man that got into Harvard only because of affirmative action. He used it. This is the thing that helped him get to where he is. And for him to burn down that bridge for other people to cross, to me, it's unforgivable. It's unforgivable. You know, Clarence Thomas says two things. He says that one of the reasons he believes that affirmative action should be done away with as far as admissions practices in schools is because that the stigma of affirmative action and he being able to use that to get into Harvard has followed him his entire adult life, and he thinks that people have not taken him as serious an academic because of the program of affirmative action that he used to get in. And he doesn't want black people to have to feel that way like he's felt, almost like an academic charity case. But that's not how affirmative action works. You can't be the lowest of the low, the dregs of academics, and get into a Harvard just based on your race. That's not how it works. And he knows this. So to put that out there like that is incredibly misleading. And it's not just misleading to black folks. The worst is that it's misleading to white folks because it confirms what they believe to be the truth about affirmative action. And that's that we don't have to be as good as they are to get in. All we have to do is be black with no other credentials, no other academic credentials. And then we can walk through the doors of a Harvard or a Yale or any other Ivy League school just based on our skin tone. Clarence Thomas, more than anyone, knows this not to be true. So for him to put that out there like that really, really bothers me. It's the true tap, dance, and shuffle for his white friends, billionaires, that are truly buying his vote. The other thing that Clarence Thomas keeps saying, which is an absolute lie, is that affirmative action hurts Asian Americans' chances of attending college, when in fact, according to a study released by the U.S. Department of Education, Asians have the highest college enrollment rate among all ethnic groups at 59%. A study from Georgetown University also found that Asian Americans actually benefit from affirmative action. If colleges only considered test scores, while Asian American enrollment would increase slightly, 21% of Asian Americans admitted under the holistic system would lose their spot. In short, Asian Americans with lower SAT and ACT scores would give up their admission to Asian Americans with higher test scores. This would potentially affect lower income Asian Americans who cannot afford to spend money to prepare for those tests. Here's the funny part. The Asian American Legal Defense and Education Fund and 32 Asian American groups and higher education faculty released a statement in support of Harvard's admission of policy and affirmative action, saying that abolishing affirmative action would mostly benefit white applicants, not Asian American. Now look, I'm no Perry Mason. So if I can find these facts in 10 minutes, I know that Clarence Thomas knows these facts off the top of his head. So the fact that he and others are out here misrepresenting these truths in order to change laws that damages people's futures and ruins their opportunities, to me, is criminal. And the fact that it can be done so brazenly and so easily without fear of any repercussion legally is scary to me. In the last 4 years, this right-winged, ultra-conservative, heavy Supreme Court has watered down the Voting Rights Act, has repealed Roe v. Wade, which protected women's reproductive and abortion rights, has just recently watered down discriminatory laws that allow LGBTQ persons in this country to be discriminated against, and has now abolished affirmative action. All the laws on the books that were placed there that make this country more of an even playing field. What's next? I don't know what's next, but I'm fearful of what's next. But I'm also not an expert in law. But I do have someone today who is, and hopefully he can calm my fears. Chief Judge retired Robert Bell is with me today, and he came along during the Civil Rights era, and as a black man, did attend Harvard right out of Morgan during that time. So he has quite the insight on what's going on now and what went on then. And I can't wait to sit down and pick his brain about this. So 1500, please help me welcome to Let's Talk, once again, Chief Judge retired, Robert M. Bell. All right, Judge Bell, thank you so much for joining me today. I really appreciate you coming on and taking the time. I know that there's a lot that I wanted to talk to you about, and I wanted to get it from your perspective and how you feel about affirmative action being repealed by the Supreme Court. Now, when did you start your law career?
I started in 1966.
Okay.
And I finished in 1969. So it was a little bit before the Supreme Court or the Fed started to evaluate these affirmative action plans. But I must say that the plan that Harvard was operating under in this case did not differ particularly much from the plan that under which I was admitted.
So how were you admitted?
I applied, and of course, you provide all the information that the application calls for, and you do an essay, that explains why you want to be admitted to college, to the law school and whatnot. And it's my understanding that what Harvard does is look at you as a whole person.
Okay.
In other words, they look at you holistically.
Okay.
Including your race, and make a determination at the end of the day whether or not you would be one of the people who are able to succeed at that school.
Okay.
And also whether that your admission would contribute to the diversity, which was really a goal of the school in reaching out to minority communities. Now, I was the first African-American from Morgan to be admitted to the law school. And, you know, what they used to say about, you know, what you do reflects on your race and that sort of thing.
Right.
My performance at Harvard resulted in two more African-Americans from Morgan being admitted the next year. So they were looking for to determine whether or not a particular person from a particular school with a particular background could succeed. And if so, that put that school on the map, and they would use that school in the future in terms of admitting students to their classes. And it wasn't only blacks now, by the way.
Okay.
I remember I had a discussion with a fellow named Frank Flanninger, who was from one of the Midwestern colleges and states. I think it was Iowa, who was from a small school, no background of performance, and certainly nobody from that school had been admitted to Harvard Law School up to that time. And they admitted him because he represented another class of persons that would contribute to the diversity that the school was looking for. You know, a white who was from, you know, a school in a particular area, rural area of the country, whose presence was not represented on that on the campus.
Do you think, Judge, that affirmative action, do you think it lessened the opportunities of whites? Do you think it was something that was discrimination against whites at that time?
No, because you see, the thing that people keep forgetting is you don't even get into the pool unless you're qualified.
Okay.
You know, the big thing is we have a pool of qualified applicants. Now, we've got to come to terms with whom we're going to admit from that pool because we don't have as many slots as we have people in the pool.
Okay.
It's a question of how do you winnow that down to come up with a class that is fairly selected, of course, but represents something which the school thinks is important, which is a diverse student body, because that student body will benefit not only the person who's admitted, but all of the students in the school. And so, you know, I don't think it diminishes anybody, because you're not starting from a situation where you're moving somebody up who would not otherwise be qualified.
Okay.
You're not depriving somebody who is qualified, except to the extent that you've got a larger goal that you want to meet, which is a diversity goal, which is what was going on at that point.
Why do you think the Supreme Court repealed that decision?
Well, it's part of an agenda, apparently, because, you know, what they've done is to overrule a whole bunch of precedents. Affirmative action, use of race as a part of a holistic approach to admissions had been upheld by the Supreme Court since Brown.
Right.
And all of a sudden, without expressly doing it, they overruled all those precedents and said you can't use race. And they did it on the basis that the Constitution is colorblind.
Correct.
That is the most asinine thing you ever read. The Constitution has never been colorblind.
Right.
And particularly if one looks at the Civil War amendments, it's clear that those amendments were supposed to be remedial.
Correct.
They didn't dictate colorblindness. They were supposed to remedy past conduct, which resulted in the disadvantage of those who sought to become part of the American fabric in a wholesome way, and so the court misread the civil rights, the Civil War amendments, the legislation that occurred shortly thereafter, and the cases that upheld the use of race as one way of ameliorating some of the disadvantage that had been impeded upon in a disadvantaged portion of the population for some time. And so, no, I think it's part of an agenda, apparently, because not only did they overrule those cases, you know, they did the same thing last year with the Roe case.
Correct.
And they've done the same thing with, what was the other one? They just did that LGBT.
Oh, yes, sir.
Q
yes,
case. Sir. So it seems to me that it's part of an activist intent to take us back to a period from which I thought we'd already left.
Yeah, I
had left for some time, huh?
I've done a lot of reading about it, and I'm curious about Judge Clarence Thomas.
Okay.
No, honestly, I wanted to get your perspective and what your thoughts on someone who advanced his career, his education, through affirmative action, and then striking it down, saying that it's something that was unconstitutional. How does that even happen? Like, is it just a self-hatred thing, or is it? I don't get it.
Michael Dyson attributes it to the self-hatred thing. I think it really has to do with revenge. He's in revenge mode, has been in revenge mode since he received such a rough time during his confirmation proceedings. Michael did not rush to his aid and did praise him, and so he's now heaping his revenge upon the entire society, including Black America, by taking positions which seem to make no sense at all, and in fact suggest that he is perfectly willing to kick the ladder down once he has advanced, so that he becomes the only one. Apparently, he probably holds the same animosity or is acting the same way toward the latest justice on the court, Ketanji Brown Jackson.
Right.
It's inexplicable to me, but the closest thing I can come to is that he was so bitter during his confirmation proceedings that I think he made the decision to try to wreak revenge on Black folk by taking positions antithetical to their position.
Wow, I hadn't thought about it like that.
That's the only thing I can think of. But Michael Eric Dyson says it's self-hatred. I think it's been of that, too.
Why do you think Ketanji Brown Jackson recused herself, but Clarence Thomas wasn't forced to recuse herself?
She had to. I mean, ethically, that was the only thing she could do. She had been on the board of Harvard and was probably involved in some way or another with the action plan and its implementation, at least to some degree.
Okay.
And so the only ethical thing to do when you have an interest like that is to step aside. That is something that the conservative justices on the court do not do, and that's unfortunate because it does undermine the respect that the public at large has for the court.
I wonder, as do many other, a lot of people speculate, a lot of Black pundits speculate that we're going to see a huge decline in the amount of Blacks that are admitted into public and private institutions at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel the same way?
Probably. If Michigan and California are any indication, that's what's going to happen. And at the same time, you're going to see an increase in the number of HBCU applicants. So, I mean, it's going to, that seems to be the trend. That's the way it's going to go. Fewer in those law schools, in those colleges, majority colleges, and a higher number of people going to HBCUs. Some people will say that's a plus for HBCUs. But I don't know. I think it overall it's probably a negative from the standpoint of our democracy.
Now there's a clause or a stipulation also in affirmative action law that is also regarding employment. Mm-hmm. And no one's talking about that. Like, one of the big things about affirmative action, actually while it was established initially, was for the hiring practices of companies, private and government.
Well,
if you strike that down, then they can go back to the discriminatory practices that they had before.
Yeah, count on it.
Nobody's talking about that.
No, count on it. That's what's going to happen because, you know, a lot of these businesses have gone along with the program because they thought it was required. The moment they are told that it's not required and they don't have to do it anymore, then they're going to revert to old practices. So, no, I fully expect that you're going to see the impact of this decision going well beyond school admissions. We're going to have to fight this battle of trying to get back on the upward trend again, much as we did way back in the civil rights era.
And that was my question for you. How do you think, or what do you think is the best way to go about fighting this decision? I mean, it doesn't seem like right now there's anything that can be done about it. So how do we fight that?
Well, I don't know. If you read Sotomayor's opinion, she suggests that it has created a room for litigation to try to reverse some of the stuff that they've said. So, I mean, there are going to be openings for some litigation. But it seems to me that the best way to do it is the way we started in the first place, which is by direct action aimed at the schools by, you know, putting the pressure on to make sure that they do all they can do to support and to move in the direction of affirmative action, even though they don't have the ability to use race as a piece of it.
Right.
Find other ways of reaching the same result. It's going to be somewhat creative. Now, Robert says, well, you can write this essay and give us your thoughts on why race is so important in making you the person you are and thus qualifying you to enter school. Well, that's what they do now.
Okay.
So I think that to some extent we're going to have to make sure that the schools recognize that while they say don't use race, you know, there are ways of not using race, but at the same time recognizing it.
Yeah, I fear, along with the education aspect of affirmative action, I fear more the employment aspect of it. And I also fear the contract aspect of it. Government was forced at that time because of affirmative action to make sure minority companies got government contracts at a particular rate. And that's no longer in place. So
I said, count on it. I guess it's going to happen. That really is going to happen. It's going to take a lot of effort on our part to convince these schools, I mean, not the schools, but the governments, not governments, but businesses.
Right.
And contracting agencies that it is worthwhile to have diversity and that they ought to do all they can to ensure that we don't go backwards in that regard. It's going to be tough, but it's going to require us to once again tread that ground of forcing these folk and convincing these folks, cajoling these folks to do the right thing.
Now, you got involved in the civil rights movement, correct? What was your role in that?
I was Morgan students were involved in the civil rights movement well before the beginning of the movement in 1960. I was a student participant in sit-in demonstrations in Baltimore at a restaurant called Hooper's Restaurant.
Okay.
And in that case, we were arrested for trespassing in that restaurant because we were challenging the ability of the restaurant that's open to the public to deny service to a segment of the population, to blacks, and the use of the criminal law to enforce their private discrimination. And the case went to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court did not reach the merits of it because actions in Maryland and in Baltimore City had occurred that rendered the case moot.
Okay.
In the sense that if we had done in 1963 what we did in 1960, it would not have been illegal.
Okay.
And so the court asked the Court of Appeals of Maryland to look at the case again in that light, and the Court of Appeals of Maryland reversed itself.
Now, you spoke about the decision that the Supreme Court made on the LGBTQ front and allowing this made-up case that this woman brought to the Supreme Court about her not wanting to, I guess, make cakes or bake cakes for same-sex marriages.
Design, exactly.
Yeah. So what, I guess what I'm asking is how far is this going to, is that intertwined with civil rights? Like, how far is this going to go back? Because it seems like it could go back now to if an owner of a restaurant doesn't want to seat black people or serve black people, or, like, how far is this going to go?
I don't know. I don't know how far this religious freedom thing goes when one couples it with the fact that you've got a public accommodations law that requires you to serve everybody. I don't know. It seems to me that you are on a slippery slope, or potentially on a slippery
slope.
Because to say, because I'm religious, I don't want to do this for this person, is a discriminatory act done by a person who purports to be open to all of the service of all people in that community. And I don't know where you draw the line. If you can say, I have a religious objection to this person or that sort of thing or that sort of thing, if this opinion is right, then you have the right on religious grounds to refuse service, even though you're open to serve everybody. Doesn't make sense. I mean, we're right back to where we were, is what it looks like to me.
Yeah.
Well, potentially we're back to where we were. Except that we're not focusing on the race of the person, we're focusing on other aspects of that person's either profession or person or ideology or what, whatever, you know, whatever the difference is between that person and you.
Well, and that's the scary part. If they can start here, then there's no reason why they can't. I mean, I just don't see the difference. I mean,
You know, if you take this thing to its logical conclusion, what you're saying is public accommodations means you're open to serve everybody so long as those persons are meet the qualifications which you set for yourself or which your religion set for you, which doesn't make any sense to me.
No, it doesn't. So I guess the question is can the civil rights law be repealed at this point? I mean, it just seems like they're not stopping at anything. And because they have the advantage as far as numbers, I'm talking about Supreme Court justices, what won't they stop at?
That's the point. I mean, because they are interpreting the Constitution, you see. Passing a law is not going to help.
Yeah.
I mean, you can pass a law you want. If that law goes up and they then say, well, it doesn't pass muster under our view of the Constitution, well, then you're right back to the same place.
So that poses the bigger question for me. And you having been a judge, I'd like to know what you think about it. Do the Supreme Court justices have too much power? There doesn't seem to be any checks and balances for them. They are the final word. So who, I'm just trying to figure out, because there are some improprieties going on with them as well, as far as possibly being bought and the decisions that they make. So who checks them?
We the people. That's the way it's supposed to work. Now, what's happening is the confidence level of the public in the Supreme Court is way down.
Okay.
And apparently it's falling. And to the extent that it falls to the point where people no longer trust it, it means that something's going to have to give in that regard, because it threatens the democracy itself. So the bottom line is the power of the court rests with the trust and confidence of the people that it serves. And when those people stop trusting the decision of the court and stop paying any attention to it, then its legitimacy is gone, and something will have to be done to regain that legitimacy. Which means that somebody's going to probably have to resign. You're going to have to replace justice. You have to expand the court those sorts of things are going to have to be looked at to determine how you could get to the point where you can regain the, you can have the court regain the legitimacy that it needs in order for the democracy to work as it should. Because, you know, what's supposed to be happening is the court is supposed to resolve the issues that may arise between the other two branches and between the states. And its word is the final say. And the reason it's the final say is because the people trust the court to do the right thing, to be above the fray and not political. So that balance will have to be regained if it ever loses it to the point where, I mean, I think it's down to 30% now.
Right.
If it goes much lower than that, it seems to me that some things are going to start to happen in the other two branches and in the public, because the outcry will be so loud that the court will get the message that it can't continue along that path. And I think there were some issues about the court in the Roosevelt administration. He was going to pack the court.
Right.
And apparently it got to the point where, you know, things were so bad and it got so close that the court started to change its mind and started changing the way it viewed some of the problems and some of the issues that were being brought by the Roosevelt court. So it could happen. The trigger is going to be the public's loss of confidence. But the reaction is going to have to either come from the court or from actions by the Congress to change the makeup of the court.
How do you feel about packing the court? Do you think it's something that's necessary right now?
I don't think that's the answer, quite frankly.
No.
No, because the moment you pack the court, then somebody else gets the other party gets in the next time they don't like the makeup of the court. They'll pack it again, and so you'll end up with an ever-ending change in the court, which doesn't get to the root cause of the problem. The problem with the court is you've got ideologues on the court as opposed to people who are well-trained in the law.
Right.
And who respect the law and the precedents that have been set. Because part of the issue is, can we rely on what has happened last year? If I decide a case as a justice on the Supreme Court, I decide that case last year, and then I go off the court, and you replace me.
Right.
And you get the same case, and you decide it the other way. There's no predictability.
Yeah, see, I don't understand
ad hoc decision-making. And that is the antithetical to trust and confidence in that particular body.
Right, well, that's what I don't understand. I mean, you can help me understand this. During the confirmation process,
they lied,
and that's what I'm saying. Like, there should be some accountability for what you say during the confirmation process as to what you vote on once you're in the seat, because they're two different things.
You can impeach him. You can impeach him. You can impeach him.
Well, so then why hasn't this happened? Because there's been at least three.
Because they can't guarantee they'd get a conviction. Think of what happened with Trump, for example.
Okay.
He was impeached. The case was proven.
Right.
But you need two-thirds vote of the Senate to remove, and you're not going to get that.
So then it's just what's wrong with it? It's like a mock court then. It doesn't really, it's nothing.
No, we've never had, I don't think we've ever had it quite like this, because we've always had justices that were willing to put aside their ideological leanings,
okay,
and rely on the law. I mean, you take the Warren Court, for example. I mean, Earl Warren was a right-wing supposed ideologue. That's why he was appointed.
Right.
He got to the court and he started looking at the law and applying it to the cases that came before him, and he did not vote like an ideologue. I know he may very well have believed what he believed when he was involved in that Japanese internment case.
Right.
But he didn't act that way when he was Chief Justice of the court. I mean, he was governor at the time. And now as Chief Justice, the law had a majesty for him. He, he started to follow the law. He looked at the precedents. He applied them. Same thing with Black, who had been a member of the Ku Klux Klan. These guys, they had a reverence for the law.
What was that case?
Hmm?
Well, which judge are you talking about when you say Black? I'm not familiar.
Justice Black. He was one of the justices on the Warren Court.
Okay.
And he was called one of the liberal judges. Justices, but it was a group of those guys who may have been ideological one way or the other who once they were on that court applied the law and did not apply their own point of view and did not try to impose their point of view on others.
Okay.
They looked at precedent and they applied the precedent. This crowd, it seems to me, is intent upon ideologically remaking the country. And that's the problem.
So when you look at things like affirmative action,
mm-hmm.
Roe v. Wade,
mm-hmm.
and you look at the makeup of the court, the Supreme mm-hmm. Court, do you think it's something, I don't know, it just seems like it's so irreversible, these decisions, that in my lifetime, I won't see any of it reversed.
So, you probably won't, unless some of these people leave the court for some reason, and you had an opportunity to put different judges on. No, you probably won't.
Right.
But in the long haul, the court will change, and it will either readjust to what it used to be, or it will continue along the ideological bent that it's on right now. If that happens, then I say we've lost the democracy altogether. I don't think we can survive it.
Do you think this is a good thing for HBCUs?
Not really.
No.
I mean, I think in the short term, it's probably going to help HBCUs because you're going to have people who might have applied to the majority colleges and universities probably saying, why waste my time?
Right.
And they'll go to HBCUs, but that means that you're going to lose that viewpoint in these other colleges, and it's not going to end well.
You know, when you were on the show the last time, I asked you a question. I asked you if you felt that integration was something that was good or bad for Black folks, and you said that you were kind of torn. Right.
Well, no, I've come a long way on this one because, you know, I used to be a staunch proponent of what Thurgood and Charles Hamilton Houston were trying to do.
Right.
I'm not as convinced anymore because I think back to where we were when I was in school. And the kinds of teachers and direction we had. And I'm not sure we see that same kind of concern and commitment today.
Right.
And so so we've lost something. And so I'm not nearly so strongly in favor of integration now as I was.
Right, and that's my point. I'm wondering if this is something that might not just help HBCUs, but also help the Black communities, because we're forced almost to stay within ourselves at this point, if it'll help us grow closer together or more united.
Yeah, but the problem is that to say that is also, and this is where the ambivalence comes in, to say that is to say that the... that our constitutional democracy can exist in as flawed a fashion as it is. I think bottom line is, while I don't like the way things have been and the way things are trending at the moment,
right,
in order for this to be a healthy democratic democracy, we've got to continue to strive toward that more perfect union in the sense that people... everybody is engaged in the democracy and not in his or her independent pursuits. You see what I mean?
I do.
Mm-hmm.
I do.
Because, you know, my theory is that we'll never reach the more perfect union at all.
Okay.
But if we get to the point where we stop trying to, then we may as well stop trying to maintain the democracy itself.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. I just feel like, I don't know, I just don't, I'm very, very nervous and almost scared about where the country's going in regards to civil rights and race relations. And
You should be. Yeah. You should be. And this next election is going to be critical. This next election is going to be real critical because, you know, you've got, I was telling somebody the other day, we've got more people in this country who believes in the right things.
Right.
But we got a whole lot of people who don't.
And they're the loudest, unfortunately.
Not only are they loud, being loud doesn't trouble me, it's the fact that they do vote.
Right.
They will come out and vote no matter what. Drop of a hat, they'll vote. Our folk, the folk who are on the right side, tend not to be as reliable.
Yeah, we're too passive.
In that regard.
Right.
And it is that which is our biggest problem, it seems to me.
Yeah.
I don't know whether they'll hew the line to the point that they're needed. They did it the last time, but will they continue to do it when the situation to them is not as ideal as it might have been last time?
Yeah, but I think when you see things moving backward the way that they've moved backwards just in the last, I don't know, 5 or 6 years, major things. It almost seems like your vote doesn't matter. Like we put a Democratic president in office,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
But the laws still seem to be going backwards in favor mm-hmm. of conservatives. So it doesn't mm-hmm. seem to matter. And I'm sure people throw up their hands in the end, like, so what's the point? You know what I mean?
Yeah, but that's what I see. That's where this is one of my pet peeves. We don't really focus on the responsibilities of citizenship. We only focus on the rights of citizens. And therein lies the rub. A citizen who does exactly what a citizen's responsibility is
uh-huh.
would understand that there are certain interactions that must occur in order to get things done.
Okay.
You've got one side who's not doing it, and the other side trying to do it. It'll not happen, or things will stagnate. And you have to know whether to hold the person who's trying to get it done responsible, or those who are trying to rail against it, hold them responsible.
Right.
And if you understand those interrelationships, you're more likely to be able to discern who ought to be elected, as opposed to having a feeling about or a personality trait that you focus on. And that is what the problem is. If you look at what Biden has done, just to use him as an example,
right.
He has done everything he's promised to do, at least tried to, but has not been able to do it. Why? Because the other side's not helping.
Correct.
So when you go to the vote, you hold it against him that he wasn't able to get it done, or do you hold against the people who were pushing back and keeping him from getting it done? Do you hold them responsible?
That we keep in office by not voting them out.
That's right. That is if the responsible citizen would then say, no, we need to get rid of these folk because they are the impediment, and we can get something done by keeping these people in. And if you had people thinking like that, and they had knowledge of the system, and they were engaged in the system, and they participated in the system, we would be better off. What we've got are dumb constituents, people who do not do the hard work of trying to figure out what's going on. They right. have no clue about how the system works. They don't care. They just listen to somebody who's a demagogue telling him what's going on.
Right.
And as long as that happens, we're in trouble. We are in serious trouble.
We're definitely in serious trouble.
And you're talking about, you know, we used to have civics. which emphasized both sides of the coin. You know, you have certain rights, yes, but you've got certain responsibilities to protect those rights.
Right.
Wow. Until we get back to that, we're going to be, we're not going to get out of this thing very easily, because our folk on the right side still will find an excuse not to vote unless it's so dire that, it's hitting them in the face every day.
Well, it's starting to do that. And I think once jobs, contracts are lost, or wages are not the same, because it's going in that direction. I mean, we talk about how history repeats itself, or how we thought it would never be the way that it was because we're protected mm-hmm. by this. All of our protection is leaving us, right?
Well, I hope you're right. I really do hope you're right. But I've seen, let's look at the last election. It is true that 7 million people more voted for Biden than voted for Trump.
Right, right.
But think about it. Trump's numbers were what, about 80 million?
Yeah, that's a large group of people.
It not only is a large group of people, it represented an increase from the last time.
Correct.
As bad as he was.
Correct.
Those people were there voting, and what's happening now? His numbers are still going up.
Well, he's becoming a martyr at this point.
Yeah, but I mean, that's because people these people are as dumb as doornails. No, that's what amounts to. I mean, they don't know facts. They don't care about facts. And all you have to do is tell them what to do, they do it.
Right.
They're like automatons, you know. As long as we've got that situation where those people are prone to vote, and we got the other side who should be much more anxious about what's going on, being more concerned about other things, it could go either way.
Right, right.
And I tell you, what bothers me, I guess, more than anything else, is that we do not call out the people who are acting like automatrons. I mean, we don't call them out. We don't call them dumb. We don't criticize them.
Right.
You know, if you criticize them, you get a whole lot of pushback. I mean, Hillary Clinton's a good example. She called them deplorables.
Yep. And that lost her.
Happened?
That lost
Everybody
her.
Everybody jumped
yep.
all over her.
They sure did. One of the things that lost
and
her.
What
the
happened? She apologized.
Yeah.
And said, "Oh no, I didn't mean to deplorable." She should have said, "The only thing I'm apologizing for is that I didn't do it often, more often than I did."
Yeah.
Because she's absolutely right.
And Trump doesn't apologize for anything.
Back, huh?
I've never heard Trump apologize for anything that he said.
But no, he doesn't tell the truth though. But she was absolutely telling the truth
right.
about these damn people. They are deplorables, and you ought to keep saying they're deplorables. Because I've learned one thing. These folks don't mind being, the one thing they don't want to be done, they don't want to have happen is be called a racist, you see.
Right.
So if you call them racist and you stick to it, then you might see some change. You might. I mean, you may not either. But I mean, at least you ought to call it what it is. And maybe they'll have the benefit of having some of them start to introspect and think about what's going on. To a greater extent than they do right now.
Right. Well, all we can do is pray about it, hope, and like you say, vote, educate ourselves and vote, educate each other and vote.
I would much prefer the people do the education as opposed to praying. Because the education is going to work.
Right. Okay. Yeah, No, you're right. But Judge Bill, listen, I appreciate you so much. You're mm-hmm. such a wealth of knowledge. And wisdom. So thank you so much for coming on today and joining me. And like I told you before, I'm going to call you again when I need
mm-hmm.
you.
Okay.
So, all right. Okay, sir. Have a great one, okay?
You too now. Thanks so much.
All right. Bye. Bye-bye. Bye. Talking to Judge Bell is like one of my highlights in life. I love talking to him. He's full of so much knowledge, and I learn something every time we speak. So thank you so much, Judge Bell, again, for coming on to the show. But I know you hear the music, and that can only mean one thing on this show, and that means it's time for the Petty. Let's give the Petty a call and see what he's talking about today.
Good morning. Brother B, how are you?
I'm good, man. How you doing, Petty?
Just great. And how are you yourself?
I'm hanging in there, man. I apologize. You know, We've had to suffer through 2 weeks of reruns, but we're back live on the new Let's Talk. So what you got for me?
Man, listen, first and foremost, let's talk about the USFL championship game last weekend, where the Birmingham Stallions repeated as USFL champs.
Okay.
Now,
okay.
They defeated the Pittsburgh Maulers, and it was a lackluster championship game. I really had a hard time getting into it. I watched it, and it just wasn't. You know what? I like the XFL better than I like the USFL.
So do I.
That's all I can say. And what I found out is that the XFL ratings for their championship game was higher than USFL. Now, I know I said earlier that the USFL had better players, like the play on the field was better, but I got to admit, I like the XFL better.
It has so much more personality. I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's because they play in a smaller venue and the crowds are on top and they're I don't know what it is, but it's so much more personality to the game.
I can honestly say that I think it's because that the USFL plays in hub cities, whereas the XFL play in the cities that they represent. And I think that's a huge difference.
Yeah, probably. You're probably right.
Both the leagues.
Yeah, you're probably right.
Now, I've kept my ear to the ground on this one. I heard that the NFL is considering doing spring football to compete with the USFL and the XFL. You know, I said this a while back that the NFL should just pump some money into the XFL and the USFL and make that like the minor leagues of the NFL, because there have been players that have been going from the XFL into the NFL. And recently, the Dallas Cowboys just signed one of the USFL kickers to be on their squad in the upcoming season. So maybe instead of competing with the XFL and the USFL, why don't they just all find a way to sit down at the table and say, hey, let's make this work. Yeah, and I know you had made a comment before when I mentioned that about, you know, Dwayne The Rock Johnson maybe not wanting to give up that type of control, or whoever's in control of the USFL not wanting to give up their control. But you know what? I think it makes sense, instead of having three leagues playing in the spring, just all merge and just, you know, do one big thing.
Yeah, listen, man, what players are going to contribute or participate in spring football after having a grueling fall season?
And you know what? I understand what you're saying, but see, there are a lot of players who don't have the opportunity to showcase their talents in the NFL. So maybe a stepping stone to get to the NFL would be for them to go to the USFL or the XFL. And like I said, if the NFL is interested in doing a spring league, then maybe they should sit down with those two leagues and find a way to make it work.
Oh, okay. So you're saying that the NFL would have their own spring league, not the same. Okay. I see what you're saying now. Okay.
So let's see what happens with that in the near future. Speaking of things that just really, really hit next to me, and that's one of them, that the USFL was just very lackluster. I'm going to turn to baseball a little bit, and I really wanted to save this for last, but I just feel like I got to talk about it right now.
Okay.
I'm going to talk about your high-flying Baltimore Orioles, who are one of the top five teams in the major leagues. I'm not talking about the American League. I'm not talking about the National League. I'm talking about in the MLB. I'm talking about the Orioles, one of the top five teams. They are the top team as far as a wild card team in the American League.
Okay.
Now, recently, there was a poll of the percentage of teams to make the World Series, the top 10 teams to make the World Series. Do you know that the Baltimore Orioles, who are one of the top teams in the majors, was not part of that top 10 list?
Why not?
That is a very good question. Do you know who made that list?
Who?
The two teams that are under the Orioles in the wild card, the Yankees and the Houston Astros. Now, you know I love my Yankees. I love the Yankees. But I am very upset that the Orioles are not even mentioned in that conversation. They were not on that list. I hope they continue to do what they're doing right now. I watched that game Thursday night, and they pummeled my Yankees.
Yeah, they beat the brakes off of the Yankees.
And I like the Yankees. You know I am a big Yankee fan, but they pummeled the Yankees. And maybe they saw that list and say, hey, we're going to send a message to the rest of the league. You better watch out for these high-flying birds.
They beat them they beat them like 14-1 or something, right? Yeah.
Right. They beat the brakes off of them. So I'm a little upset because those high-flying birds are not being mentioned. And I think that's kind of a good thing, because they're going to sneak up and they're going to catch a lot of people off guard.
There's
and
no pressure
they
on
themselves.
They have zero pressure on them.
And that's a good thing.
Yeah.
You know, and like I said, I'm waiting. I can't wait to end the season because I think they have a good chance to maybe sneak in and be the top of the AL East because just the past couple of days ago, the Philadelphia Phillies went down into Tampa and swept them. And that's the only team that has swept the Tampa Bay Rays in their home stadium all season.
Okay.
And the Phillies are okay. They're not that great of a team.
They're not that great of a team.
But they went into Tampa and swept them all three games. So maybe that you know, that thing with Tampa is starting to, I don't know, man. You saw what happened to the Florida teams in the NBA championship.
Yeah.
You saw what happened to them in the NHL championship. Yeah. So maybe it's starting to happen with the baseball team too.
I think that a lot of baseball pundits think that after the All-Star break is really it really determines who's going to be hot and who's not going to be hot, right? Some teams really heat up after the All-Star break, and that's who makes the playoffs, not the ones that are hot before.
Well, let me tell you something, Brother B. I kind of agree with that, but those birds have been on fire all season long. I remember when I first talked about them, you said, well, it's still early in the season. Who are these guys? We've got to wait and see. Yeah, well, after they put their beat on the Yankees, I think a lot of people starting to open their eyes about those high flying birds.
Well, that was your father that had that kind of critique. He was the one that was saying it's a little early in the season to get excited about them. So, I don't know.
How can you not be excited about it? How can the city of Baltimore not be excited about it? No, I'm serious, Brother B. I've been down to the stadium. I've seen the crowd. I've looked at ESPN, FS1, Fox Sports. Nobody's real. I'm looking at stuff online. Nobody's really talking about them. They are.
Right.
And they are a hot, let me tell you, man. They are a hot team right now. You got to look out for them. You know,
yeah.
I anticipate them coming up to Philadelphia to play the Phillies in the next coming weeks. I'm really looking forward to that.
Right.
And speaking of the next coming weeks, my favorite time of the year is getting ready to start, and I'm talking about the NFL. Those training camps, though, they're getting ready to start up, Brother B. It's going to be happening pretty soon. And in the next coming weeks, before the season starts, I will give you a breakdown of who I think will be the top of the tops.
Okay.
The best
okay.
of the best in each division. And I'm talking about in the AFC and the NFC. And finally, one last note, we got a big fight coming up pretty soon. And it's been in the making. And hopefully, it will put boxing back on the map. And I'm talking about the Spence Crawford fight. I'm looking forward to that, Brother B.
So am I.
And I believe it's July 28th. And I hope that it's a nice showing for boxing. Boxing has kind of fell off lately. You know, women's boxing seems to be a little bit more popular than the men's boxing. Maybe because there's so many divisions for men's championship. And, you know, there's only a select few women out there boxing and looking good when they're doing it.
Right.
So, but there's so many divisions out there, so many belts out there. The WBC, the WBO, the IBF, the WBA, and everything else that's out there. And there's just so many weight classes. But this one might be a great one, and I really hope that it is.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm a huge boxing fan, but I'm really, really a female boxing fan. I mean, a huge one. I'm a huge Clarissa Shields fan. Fran Sean Cruz went over to London and lost to Matthews, which I was really, really disappointed in. So the big fight now is the rematch between Clarissa Shields and Matthews, and it's going to happen on American soil instead of, you know, English soil or British soil, so I'm excited about that one, too. But this Crawford-Spence fight, I mean, nobody's got anything coming for Crawford. Nobody.
Speaking of Clarissa Shields, you know, she's dabbled a little bit into the MMA arena. And, you know, she looks pretty good. She suffered her first defeat. And mainly it's because it's her technique, the experience. And she put on a good show, even though she lost.
Right.
But it's more or less like, you know, she needs to have a little bit more experience in that arena. I think that she should stick to what she knows best. This is just my opinion. And that's boxing, female boxing, where she is a champ. And I don't think anybody can take her down in that arena.
No, I don't think so either. But we'll see. We'll see.
And there's one other big fight that I'm really hoping that it comes out to be something special. And I'm talking about Canelo Alvarez and Jermell Charlo in September. In Vegas, a battle of two undisputed champions, and only one can wear the crown. I'm looking forward to that one also.
Yeah, I like Charlo a lot. I like he and his brother, but I got Canelo in that fight.
You got Canelo?
Well, I did.
Don't count Charlo out. I mean, he might pull it off. I think that's going to be a huge fight. That ranks right up there with the Crawford Spence fight. And hopefully, just those two fights alone will bring a good name to boxing once again.
I'm with you. I think the heavyweight division has to come alive before boxing becomes popular again. I mean, I do.
I really, really am disappointed in the heavyweight division, because when I remember the heavyweights, and I'm going back as far as Joe Frazier, Muhammad Ali, George Foreman, Ken Norton, and just to name a few, the heavyweight division was so popular. You couldn't wait to see a heavyweight fight.
Exactly.
Nowadays, the heavyweight fight is like, who cares? You know what I mean? So let's see what happens with these two fights coming up in the next 7 weeks and what months. And hopefully the heavyweights will make an appearance, and we'll be talking about heavyweight boxing again. On that note, Brother B, I got to go. Enjoy the rest of the day. Love the show. I'm out.
Peace. All right. Peace, brother. Take care, man. Out. All right. Well, there goes the Petty. Who knows what he's up to today, but I appreciate him always taking the time to come on today. Thank you today for coming and taking the time with me at 10 a.m. I'll be here every Sunday morning at 10 a.m. until 11. Don't forget, before me, we've got Sunday Morning Soul. They're going to stir you up a little bit before you get to me. So please, make our new Sunday lineup your new Sunday morning lineup. We hope to hear from you, see you, talk to you. We're going to be having several events upcoming throughout the area where we're going to be making personal appearances. You can come down and holler at us. I look forward to that. And also, don't forget, I love to get feedback from you guys. I love to get questions from you guys, ideas about guests I can have on the show. So please hit me on Instagram at On with Brian Pettaway. And yes, I know I've got to change it to Let's Talk with Brian Pettaway. But right now it's still at On with Brian Pettaway on Instagram. Let me know what you think. Give me some feedback. It's always helpful. And hopefully, I'll hear from you. Also, if you've missed any of these shows, again, you can go to my website, voiceswired.com. They're chronicled by date. You can always go to the Let's Talk tab, hit the tab, and you'll get a rerun of all of the shows that we've done so far. Again, I want to thank my guest, Chief Judge, retired Robert M. Bell. You know, he said some things today that ring very true. And one of the things that he has said, which is and has always been true in this country, is that we have to know what's going on in politics. We have to know. We can't turn a blind eye and wait for someone else to do our job of voting for us. We have to vote the people in office that we want in office. And in doing that, we will vote the people out of office that don't need to be there. So get involved, participate, use the voting rights that people died for, and pay attention. Please pay attention. All right, listen, I gotta go. It's the end of that hour. Again, thank you for being here. And today, please relax. Enjoy the day. Do nothing. And like I say every Sunday, and it won't change, that the best thing about doing nothing is you can quit whenever you want. Get up tomorrow morning. Conquer the world. Let that be your attitude. Be the best you that you can be and have the best week that you can have. And I'll see you again here next Sunday morning at 10 a.m. Take care, people. Peace.